If you grew up a baseball fan in the late 90s and early 2000s, then you were one of two people. You would either field grounders and make jump throws against the fence, screaming "Jeter" on every rep, or you picked up a bat and there was only one batting stance you would ever recreate: Gary Sheffield. His iconic bat waggle launched a generation of wannabe Sheffields and more than 500 home runs during his legendary 21-year career. And while everyone knows Sheffield for his power and his imposing batting stance, many don't realize that Gary was one of the best pure hitters of a generation. However, to say that Sheffield was an average defender would be a compliment. In fact, you could make a good case that Sheffield is the worst defender on the current Hall of Fame ballot. That raises the question, what kind of case can he have if he only had an impact on one side of the ball in a two-sided game? Does his offensive dominance outweigh his defensive deficiencies? Is Gary Sheffield the anti-Omar Vizquel? We'll take a look at Sheffield's fascinating case, which may be the Marlins' best chance at a Hall of Famer for a long time, and where this past year's results leave Sheffield on this episode of Big Hall Talk. Welcome to Big Hall Talk, everybody. I'm Ethan Badowski, and I don't care how many players make the Hall of Fame, so long as the right ones do. One of the guys that I would really love to see get in, and I know a lot of Marlins fans would as well, is Gary Sheffield. Because, like I said, he might be the best chance that the Marlins have for a long, long time, you know, because after him, I can't really see anybody from the Marlins getting in, you know, and until, you know, maybe they groom a Hall of Famer in this new generation of baseball. So certainly a lot of Marlins fans will be interested in this. Before we take a look at what really were his prime years in South Florida, and we'll get into that eventually, you know, with the Marlins, and we're going to do that as we dive into his career. Let's take a look at how it all started and how he got to Miami and then where he went after that. So he's actually a Florida boy. He's from Tampa, and some interesting just like early life facts that I gathered from researching him are that his family, his uncle is Doc Gooden, the legendary Mets pitcher, and his family actually lived with his uncle Doc in Tampa while he was growing up. He went to the Little League World Series, and he was actually on a team that went to the finals in 1980, and they lost to Taiwan in the final. But in that tournament, he actually set a record for doubles in the Little League World Series, and that record actually lasted until 2012. So he wasn't just, you know, a guy that showed up in Williamsport. He really made a big impact, and that was certainly a sign of things to come with Gary. And then really in high school is where it took off. He played at Hillsborough High in Tampa, and he was an absolute superstar. Just tore the cover off the ball there, and that led him all the way to his senior year winning Gatorade National Player of the Year, which is a huge honor. It's basically, you know, for football, it's like the Heisman Trophy of high school. So it's a huge honor to be named Gatorade National Player of the Year. And then he would have gone on to play ball at the University of Miami, according to himself, but he was the sixth pick in the draft by the Milwaukee Brewers. He was selected by the Brewers, and he went pro, and he pretty much jumped into it right away. So now let's take a look at his career with the Brewers. He actually came up as a shortstop, which is interesting because of his defensive deficiencies. You could never imagine that Gary Sheffield at one point was a shortstop, the most important defensive position on the field, and that's why he was moved away from there. It became clear pretty quickly that he couldn't stick there. And now the Brewers had this issue of, okay, he's this outstanding hitter, but where can we play him on defense because he just can't get it done at shortstop? So they ended up moving him to third base, and he spent a lot of his early career at third base. He spent some time in the outfield and right field as well. I'm not exactly sure, you know, the breakdown of when he played third and when he played right and who he played third with and who he played right with. I know that with the Marlins, he played a lot of third base. But you know, fielding was the issue, but hitting certainly wasn't. He played three seasons in the minors, and he just absolutely dominated. I mean, like any good legend would, you know what I mean? He put up tremendous numbers in the minors. But really, it was the year in 1988. It was the final season that he spent in the minors, and this is really when, you know, he put himself on the map. He actually made the jump straight from Double A, skipped Triple A, which you know, a lot of the top prospects nowadays are skipping AAA. They might even skip AA if they're that special. But he actually skipped AAA and made the jump from AA in his third and final minor league season. And he put up amazing numbers. In 77 games, he slashed .314, .386, .591 with a .978 OPS, 19 home runs. And one of the most impressive things about Carey, and we'll talk about this a lot as we move through his career, is how low his strikeout percentage was. Just how he, just for such a power guy, you know, now you think about power hitters, you know, guys like Chris Bryant and Joey Gallo and, you know, some of these great hitters, but they strike out all the time. And the game was so different back then, but it was still, you know, power hitters still struggle with the strikeout. But not Gary, and we'll talk about that more, but he had just a 13.8K percentage in minor league baseball in that final season where he just dominated so much that he had to make the jump. The Brewers kind of had their hand forced, and he came up. He spent three seasons in Milwaukee. He struggled to stay healthy, interestingly enough. He played in less than half of the games over the course of his career in Milwaukee, and injuries were a little bit of a theme with Gary, but nothing really major. You know, so he spent three seasons there. His second season there was the one where he stayed healthy, played 125 games, and he really was a very good player. This is kind of, it wasn't really his breakout season, but this is kind of when you started seeing the signs. He slashed .294, .350, .421, a .771 OPS. So, you know, that's pretty good. That's above league average. But for Gary Sheffield, you know, that was nothing special, really. But he had a .118 weighted runs created plus and 2.9 WAR. He walked at a higher rate than he struck out. And as a player that young, coming up to the major leagues, that is just exceptional. You know, it was a different game back then. But still, you know, to be that young and walk more than you strike out is amazing. He had a very high walk rate. And it started showing the signs of the player that he could be. So this will be a common theme that you'll see throughout Gary Sheffield's career is he was traded. And this one was from the Brewers to the Padres, and this was the first in a big line of trades that Gary was involved in, and he was really involved in some big ones. So he was traded to the Padres just before the 1992 season, and this is when he absolutely broke out. He hit .330, .385, .580 with a .965 OPS and a .172 weighted runs created plus. He had 6.5 WAR, which is just tremendous. And he was second in home runs and RBIs, so he nearly won the Triple Crown because he did win the batting title hitting .330. And this was also the year he won his first Silver Slugger. He would go on to win 5, and we'll talk about those later on. But this is really when he jumped onto the scene with the Padres, and so much so that the Marlins, the jumpstart Marlins, he caught their eye so much that they went out and got him in one of two blockbuster trades, you could say, that Gary was involved in. So now we move into the Marlins phase of his career. He was traded to the Marlins. It was their first season in 93, and he was traded in June. He had 10 home runs at this point in the season, so, you know, he was hitting pretty good. He was hitting below .300. But the Padres saw an opportunity to get Trevor Hoffman, who, yeah, he was pretty good, right? I mean, he wasn't terrible. But, of course, they got the Hall of Famer Trevor Hoffman, more than 500 saves. And the Marlins got their guy, Gary Sheffield, who would help them go on to win a World Series in return. So what a, you know, crazy deal. Two guys that, you know, one of them's in the Hall of Fame. One of them is getting closer to getting in the Hall of Fame. And you don't see that very often, but with Sheffield, you actually do. And we'll talk about that more in a second. But, you know, this is where Sheffield took off in Miami. This is what you could really consider his prime years. You know, guys usually have peaks and then they have their primes. So Gary's prime was kind of in Miami, and I really didn't realize that, you know, until recently. I knew he was a great player, and I kind of thought that his prime, because when I was growing up, he was on the Yankees, and he was so dominant on the Yankees, I thought that was it, but it was way earlier than that, and it was actually these 4 or 5 years that he spent in Miami. He basically played 5 seasons here because he came over in the middle of a season from the Padres, and then he played 4 full seasons, and then he was traded in the middle of a season to the Dodgers. But he was amazing in Miami. He never had a weighted runs created plus under .123, which means he was never less than 23 points above league average, which is just amazing. You know, and he never had an OPS below 837 in Miami. And really, it was only 1 year that he didn't put up, you know, just outstanding numbers. But his best season was actually 96, not 97, when the Marlins would win the World Series, though he did play a big part in that. But his best season was in 96. It's arguably the best season of his career. He hit 314, 465 on base percentage, 624 slugging, 1.090 OPS, so an OPS over 1,000, 42 homers, 185 weighted runs created, plus a 21 walk percentage. You want to talk about how his OBP was so high? He walked 21% of the time and only struck out 9.7% of the time. So he more than doubled the amount that he struck out in terms of how much he walked. He had 6.5 WAR, and somehow he only finished sixth in MLP in NL MVP voting that year, which is just crazy to me. He did win his second Silver Slugger, and this was just an amazing year for Gary. This was really, you know, kind of him peaking. This was kind of him, you know, getting towards the top and becoming truly one of the best players in baseball. And then it continued next year. You know, you could consider 97 kind of a down year for him, quote unquote, because by his standards, it was nothing very special. He only had a 138 weighted runs created plus, which means he was only 38 points above league average at the plate, which it sounds ridiculous to say only, or that was a down year for him, but that's just the kind of standard that Gary Sheffield set in his career, was that kind of dominance was, you know, regarded as one of his worst years. But he was dominant in the postseason. And in the postseason, you know, he really helped the Marlins on their way to that world championship. He played a huge part of it. In the 97 postseason, he hit 320 with a 521 on base, 540 slug, 1061 OPS, 3 home runs, 7 RBIs. He scored 13 runs, and he was on base so much, that's why he scored so much. He walked 28.2% of the time, and he had a 192 weighted runs created plus. You know, it's a short sample, so obviously, because it's the playoffs, so obviously the numbers, you know, look super dominant, but he was just outstanding, and he, like I said, played a huge part in bringing Miami their first of two world championships. Gary was a key part, and the Marlins certainly feel that Trevor Hoffman trade, you know, despite trading one Hall of Famer, they certainly feel that they got the best end of that because they got their guy. And, you know, when the Marlins decided to break it all down like they did after 97 and they did after 03, Sheffield was obviously a guy that they felt had a lot of value. So they shipped him off to Los Angeles. And again, this is the second time in his career that Sheffield was involved in a trade with a Hall of Famer. This time, he was traded to the Dodgers, and the Marlins in return got Mike Piazza. Now, you might be saying, well, Mike Piazza was a Marlin, and, you know, a lot of Marlins fans might know this, but other people might not know that. Yes, Mike Piazza was, in fact, a Marlin. And he only played 5 games, and then the Marlins traded him to the rival Mets, where, of course, he would dominate and become the Hall of Famer that he is. This was after 7 seasons in L.A., where he had already become an established, you know, very, very good catcher in the league. But Sheffield was shipped for him, and then the Marlins went their separate ways with Piazza. But this is kind of when Sheffield went out to L.A., you know, you can say that the Marlins was his prime, but if you want to talk about his peak sort of continued out in L.A. He never had a weighted runs created plus below 141 with the Dodgers, or an OPS below 930. So he actually was maybe even better in L.A., but he didn't have that 1 year like 96. You know, you want to talk about his peak. His peak is as good as they come, from 93 to 01. So those are the years that he was with the Marlins and then with the Dodgers. Look at this slash line. Look at these numbers for this player. 300 batting average, .425 on base, .558 slugging, a .984 OPS. He hit 251 home runs in that time. He had a 157 weighted runs created plus, and he had a 1.51 walk to K ratio, which shows that he just found a way to get on base, and he was such a good hitter, had such a good eye at the plate, was so disciplined that despite hitting all those home runs and hitting for all that power, he still found a way to get on base and not strike out, not make you pay at the plate. 31.9 WAR in those years, or 31.9, yep, WAR in those years. Outstanding. That's Hall of Fame pace right there. Six-time All-Star and two-time Silver Slugger from 93 to 01. So you look at that peak, and like I said, it doesn't really get much better than that. That is as good as it comes when you're talking about a hitter in Major League Baseball. And obviously, you know, we're not talking about the defense. You haven't heard anything about a Gold Glove in here, but it wasn't about the defense with Gary. It was all about the offense, and his offense was so spectacular that it leads him to this case today that we see, and we'll get to really breaking it down. But anyway, on to the next location. Gary was once again traded, and this time he was traded to the Braves. He spent two seasons with the Braves, just kept on rolling, just kept on doing Gary Sheffield stuff. Was just as amazing in Atlanta as he was in LA, and there was one year that really stood out, and that was his year in 2003, when he would actually have the highest WAR of his career. So you could say that 96 was the best season at the plate because he had, you know, the highest weighted runs created plus, which I think to me is the best way to judge, you know, how good you really were at the plate. But in 03, he had 7.3 WAR, which he won his third Silver Slugger that year, his first of three straight at this point in his career. So he kind of revitalized himself. You know, it kind of seemed like, okay, maybe, you know, now he's in Atlanta, but he just kept rolling. It just was another train just rolling right along. And let's talk about the 2 years that he had in Atlanta. So these are the two combined years. He hit .319, .412, .562 slug, .974 OPS, 64 home runs in two seasons, including 39 in 03, 154 rated runs created plus, 12.1 WAR to add on that 31.9 that he had with the Dodgers and the Marlins. So, you know, 12.1, 31.9, you know, he's already at above 40 WAR just with two teams, and there are still plenty of good years to come. And there were, you know, good years before that for Gary. So this Atlanta was just maybe not quite at the same level because he kind of had a little bit of a down year, but you know, 03 was truly spectacular. And he actually that year finished third behind Bonds and Pujols in MVP voting. How about those two names? He was 34 years old and he finished third behind Bonds and Pujols in the MVP voting in the National League. He was that good. 7.3 WAR in 03 was the best WAR of his career. So you can argue, you know, you can look at it and you can say that was the best year of his career. You could look at it and you could say 96 was the best year of his career. You could look at it and say 92 was the best year of his career. He had that many dominant seasons that he, you know, and he did it over so much time. I mean, this is, you know, 11 years after his breakout year, he was still hitting at this level. Truly amazing that he kept on rolling with the Braves. And then he finally got to free agency with the Yankees, and he got paid. He got a $13 million a year deal with the Yankees over 3 years. He joined that lineup of, you know, it was him and Jeter and Giambi and A-Rod, you know, looking to win world championships, and he never did win another one. He didn't win one with the Yankees. They did go to the postseason three times, but he was just as good with the Yankees as he was with the Braves or anybody else. You know, it took a little bit of a dip. It wasn't quite the same Gary Sheffield because injuries shortened his third season to just 39 games, and the numbers kind of deflated a little bit, but still absolutely fantastic. And his first year with the Yankees was, again, one of his best years. He finished second in the MVP voting in the AL that year behind Vladdy. And he hit .290, .393, .534, .927 OPS, 36 home runs. And that year, he actually hit his 400th home run in 04, the year he finished second in MVP voting. He had a .141 rated runs created plus. You know, a very, very good season. Not quite hitting at, you know, at the 300 level or, you know, upper 900 OPS like we saw, you know, weighted run created plus over 150. So you see it kind of taking a little bit of a dip here, but still just putting up fantastic numbers, you know, this late at this stage of his career. And then overall with the Yankees, he hit 290, 381, 513, 894 OPS, and 135 weighted runs created plus. So again, you see it kind of tailing off here with the Yankees, but two really good years and an injury-shortened third year that Gary spent in New York. And then he would move on from New York to the Tigers. This was kind of the twilight of his career. He was traded to the Tigers, and the Tigers paid him a bunch of money and a big extension. I think he got like $14 million a year there. He spent two seasons there. He put together a pretty nice 07, you know, nearly 20 years after entering the big leagues. And he played 133 games, you know, 265, so not quite the same level, but getting on base at a Gary Sheffield-like clip, 378, 462 slug, 839, that's good for an 839 OPS, 25 homers and 3 WAR. I don't have the age he was here, but you know, 20 years into your big league career, that's a pretty fantastic year. He did have a tough 08, and he had so much money left on his contract, and it was kind of coming to an end that the Tigers let him go. He was a free agent, and he signed with the Mets for the 09 season, and really, it was a farewell tour, and the reason was he was two homers shy of number 500 that year. Came in with 499, actually, excuse me. So he was one home run shy of number 500, and he would find it. He had a pretty good year, all things considered, you know, 21st season in the big leagues, 276, 372 on base, 451 slugging, 823 OPS. That's an above average season. He hit 10 home runs, including his number 500th, his 500th home run. He would finish on 509 is the total number for Gary Sheffield in his career, and 122 weighted runs created plus. So the thing with Gary is it never really ended. He didn't have that year where it all goes up in flames. His last season, he put up a 122 weighted runs created plus and an 823 OPS. That's above league average. That's 22 points above league average when you're talking about his weighted runs created plus. So it never got ugly for him. You never saw the skeleton of Gary Sheffield. Sure, he didn't have a great year in 08 with the Tigers, but he was still that same hitter. You know, he might not have been at that same level that he was, obviously, at his peak. It doesn't last forever, you know, unless you're frickin' Tom Brady, who won't go away. But it never got ugly either. And that's what a lot of these, you know, Hall of Famers, it never gets ugly for them. Larry Walker went out with a great World Series. Barry Bonds had a 1,000 OPS in his last year. And this was another guy where it just never got ugly. You never saw him looking not like himself. And that is truly one of the great things about Gary Sheffield's career. So you want to total it all up? Here we go. Here are the final numbers for Gary Sheffield in his career. A 292 hitter, 393 on-base percentage shows how prone he was to taking walks. 514 slugging shows his dominant home run power. 907 OPS total. 509 home runs. He is part of the 500 home run club. A 141 rated runs created plus. 62.1 WAR. You know, you talk about that WAR threshold. Some people put it at 50. Some people put it at 55. Pretty much everybody says that 60 is a lock, or at least pretty close to a lock. And 62.1 with no value on the defensive side of the ball, negative value on the defensive side of the ball. 62.1 WAR, just basically from what you do at the plate, is truly exceptional. And it shows that Gary was one of the best hitters of his generation by far. One of the greatest hitters of all time, you could argue, and certainly at his position. And we'll take a look comparing him to his position in a second. You know, 9-time All-Star, 5-time Silver Slugger, a World Series champion. You know, doesn't have the gold gloves. He doesn't have an MVP to his name. But, you know, he doesn't have a Hank Aaron Award. But he does have the recognition of, I was a 9-time All-Star. He spread those out throughout his career a lot. He had 5 Silver Sluggers. He won 2 early, 1 in 92, 1 in 96, and then he won 3 straight from 03 to 05. So he did it over the course of 21 years. He spread it all out, and it never came crashing down for him. He was still Gary Sheffield till the end, and that is what makes him so exceptional, and that's what makes his case so interesting. So now that we've taken a look at Sheffield's career and his path to where he's at now, let's take a look at his case, and let's just kind of set the table and lay out what it's all really comes down to. So here are the pros. Obviously, the pros is he's one of the best hitters of his generation. He was a model of consistency over 21 years. Like I said, it just never tailed off. He was still hitting at a very good above league average level all the way to the end of his career. You saw the dominance in the middle of his career was just amazing. His peak, I said it was, you know, the years in Miami and in Los Angeles, you could probably even add those years in Atlanta, and those years in New York were even very good. So it was just so consistent over so long, and it just shows you how difficult it is, because not every player does that. Even guys that are in the Hall of Fame, you know, had ugly ends to their career. But he didn't. He was so dominant at times. One of the most dominant players in the league, you could argue. He played 21 years, never had a bad season, and his only bad seasons, really, you know, that weren't affected by injuries. He never had a bad season that wasn't injury related, that he didn't miss a bunch of time, something like that. So when he was healthy, he was amazing throughout his career. 62 WAR, despite being a poor defender, it shows how tremendous his value was at the plate. You don't get that very often. His offensive value, according to Fangraphs, would be 21st among all players in the Hall of Fame at every position. It's above guys in the Hall of Fame like Chipper, Tomey, Eddie Matthews, Mike Schmidt. Some exceptional players that this guy is above, that he was a better offensive player than some of these players, you know, than some of these guys that first bat, you know, Chipper was surefire. Tomey is already in. Eddie Matthews is a legend. Mike Schmidt, one of the greatest players of all time. So he's better, you know, better offensively than these guys. Obviously, you know, Chipper wasn't a great defender, and certainly Tomey wasn't, but Eddie and, you know, Schmidt had their moments at, you know, at defense. So, and Schmidt, I mean, obviously, Schmidt's one of the greatest players of all time, you know, defenders of all time, but he was a better offensive player than these guys. So you have to take into the fact that he had more of an impact on the offensive side of the ball. And we'll talk about this in a second, but you have to kind of weigh, well, okay, does, you know, having a big offensive impact mean more than having a big defensive impact? And clearly it does, because he was able to rack up 62 WAR. We'll get really into the teeth of that discussion in a second. His WAR, I'm going to put him in the right field category, because that's just what I remember Sheffield at, and that's kind of what he played towards the end of his career and stuff. His WAR would put him 13th among right fielders. It would put him just behind Tony Gwynn, who you can actually, if you take weighted runs created plus into account, you could say that Sheffield's a better hitter than Tony Gwynn. I mean, Tony Gwynn was, you know, pure contact and didn't strike out more than like four times and whatever that crazy number that Gwynn has. But he would be just behind Gwynn in WAR among right fielders, so 13th, and just ahead of Dave Winfield and Andre Dawson, two legends. And it just shows how tremendous he was. And these guys were good defenders. And Sheffield wasn't, and it shows the kind of offensive value that he had, that he was still able to put up more WAR than those guys without contributing anything on the defensive side of the ball. Let's go to the negatives. Obviously, there's one big negative, and it is that he is, I'm just going to say it, the worst defender of all time. It sounds crazy to say, it sounds ridiculous, but it matches up actually. Gary Sheffield is probably the worst defender of all time. You could make a legitimate argument for it. And he actually, according to defensive value, and I don't love defensive value, it's or just defensive metrics, really, but because I don't know how you can really measure that kind of stuff, but defensive value kind of, you know, takes everything into account. He would have the single worst defensive value in the Hall of Fame by a wide margin. I'm talking, right now, it's Frank Thomas. Frank Thomas is the worst defender in the Hall of Fame. His defensive value is 33 points worse than Frank Thomas. So that just goes to show that it's really hard, but, you know, that's just what it is. And he would be the worst defender in the Hall of Fame, and he could be the worst defender of all time. He was, the other thing is he was named in the Mitchell Report, so he does have steroid connections. That's one of the reasons that he's struggling on the ballot a little bit right now. He never filled a test, though. He was named alongside guys like Bonds and Clemens with their trainer, so it's a little sticky. You know, I've mentioned that I don't keep steroid guys out, especially guys like Sheffield and Bonds and Clemens who are so dominant, but it you know, there's obviously a reason that he hasn't gotten in yet. All right, let's take a look at comparing him to some of the guys in his era, some guys that he would have gone up against in his career, and guys that he, you know, would challenge him. You know, he lost an MVP to Vlad, but here's Vlad's career numbers: 318, 379, 553, 931 OPS, 136 weighted runs created plus. So the OPS is a little higher, but 5 points less in weighted runs created plus, and Vlad only has 54.5 WAR. So Gary's got him beat there. You know, you want to talk about my guy, Larry Walker, 313, 400, 565, 965 OPS. So he's got him beat there. You know, 140 weighted runs created plus. So right around where Sheffield is. Sheffield's 141. And Larry has 68.7 WAR, and he was an outstanding defender. Larry missed a lot more games than Gary did, so it's a little tough to, you know, match WARs up. They can be a little tough, but he had just six more WAR than Gary, and he was a seven-time Gold Glover. So it shows that Gary's, you know, offensive value matches up with some of the greatest. I mean, he had more weighted runs created plus than Walker did. Here's a guy, I wanted to do this one for fun, Mike Piazza. He was traded for Mike Piazza. Piazza, one of the greatest offensive catchers of all time. 308, 377, 455, 922 OPS. So he's got, all these guys have Gary beat in OPS, and I think Gary was hurt by the end a little bit in terms of his OPS falling down to 907. But he has 140 weighted runs created plus, so Gary's got him beat there as well by a point, just like he's got Larry, and a 63.7 WAR. So just a little bit more WAR than Gary, just a little bit more valuable. But you can see that he matches up with some of the greats of his era, and all three of these guys are in the Hall of Fame, have been inducted in the Hall of Fame in the last 5-6 years, I think. So he matches up to the greats. He matches up to guys in the Hall of Fame. There's no doubt he has a Hall of Fame resume. I tried to find somebody that in the Hall of Fame that compares to him, but it was really difficult because, first of all, you can't find that bad of a defender. And then second of all, if you find, okay, well, a really bad defender but a better hitter, a guy like Reggie Jackson. Reggie Jackson played longer, so he's got 10 more WAR than Gary. So it's a little tough. There's nobody really like him, and that's what makes his case so fascinating, is it's one of the most unique players you can find out there. So his Hall of Fame comparison, I tried to find one. I had a little trouble with it, so I wasn't able to get one for you guys. But those are some guys that he, you know, matching up against those guys for most of his career. All three of those guys had the same peak around, you know, they kind of peaked around the same times, and Gary matches right up with them, and they're all in the Hall of Fame. So I'm not saying, I'm just saying. Let's talk about where he stands on the ballot. I talked about this on the last episode where I went through the ballot, but I'll just reiterate this now. I did list him in the In Trouble section, and the reason I did is because he's really toeing the line. So I'm going to reiterate where he kind of stands here. He's really walking this fine line of, if one thing doesn't go his way, then he won't get in. But if things go his way, he'll get in, probably in his last year on the ballot. So this year, it was his seventh year. He got 40.6% of the vote. He was up 10% from last year. In year 5 to year 6, he got a 16.9% jump, which is huge. He's averaging 13.5% jump the last 2 years. So if he continues at that pace, like I said, he would get in on the final ballot. He's going to need some help. You know, these ballots might start getting crowded. He might get pushed off a little bit. We don't really know what the ballots are going to look like coming down the pipe here. It could hurt Sheffield, but if he continues to jump, you know, he's got 35% to make up in 3 years, so he would get in with that 13.5% increase every year, and it would be close, but he would get in, like I said, in the last year. So will he continue to see these jumps? Will they slow down? Will somebody come on that kind of boxes him out? We don't really know, but at this current pace, yes, he would get in. But like I said, it's really close. He's walking this line, so I'm not ready to say he's safe yet. I didn't put him in one of the guys that had a huge year. I said he was kind of in trouble, so we'll see how it goes. Of course, there's always the interesting question, will his links to PEDs keep him out? You know, his image hasn't been harmed as much as guys like Bonds and Clemens, who are really the face of this whole thing, but he was named alongside Bonds in these allegations, so it's hard to say whether or not, you know, he will be affected by that. So what's the decision? Here we go. This is what the decision comes down to, basically. Okay. Can you, obviously, the number one thing is, can you put his defensive deficiencies aside? Can you say that he was so valuable on the offensive side of the ball that it doesn't matter what he did on the defensive side of the ball? Now you might be saying, Ethan, you're a hypocrite. You don't want to vote for Omar Vizquel, because Omar Vizquel only played one side of the ball. He was one of the great defenders, but he couldn't hit. And Gary Sheffield is one of the great hitters, but he couldn't field. But to me, offensive value is much more impactful than defensive value. You want to match him up correctly? Okay. Vizquel has like 46 WAR, and that's, you know, with his defensive impact. Gary Sheffield, no defensive impact, has 62 WAR. So it kind of shows that offense is much more valuable than defense. And if you've got that much WAR, if you're a 62 win player, over the course of your career, you helped your team get 62 wins. That's it. You're in. A 60, you know, to me is a pretty clear, if you pass 60, boom, that's it. You're a lock to me. And, you know, I'm obviously generous. My podcast is called Big Hall Talk, but yeah, I think that's a pretty good measure of you should be in or not. So it really comes down to, he is basically the anti-Vizquel, because Vizquel is the defense and can't hit, and Sheffield is the offense but can't field. So which one do you value more? And can you say, okay, you know, if you left Vizquel in for only playing one side of the ball, then you have to let Gary in for only playing one side of the ball, because the side of the ball he plays is much more impactful, and it helped him have a much better career and a much more valuable career when all the things shook down. So to me, if I haven't made it clear already, you've probably heard me on my ballot. Yes, Gary Sheffield, absolutely a Hall of Famer. His resume at the plate is so outstanding. It's just like, I just marveled at it. I couldn't believe, looking at these numbers, how good he was year after year after year, for how long he was good for. I tweeted something out yesterday when I was writing the show and I was doing all the research and everything. I was working on the episode, and I just couldn't believe how much of a, I used this phrase earlier, how much of a model of consistency he was at the plate. Here's a good stat for you about Gary Sheffield and how tremendous he was. Okay. Between 92 and 05, which, you know, you could say that was the year he broke out to the end of his Yankees career, he never had a weighted runs created plus below 123. And that was the year that he was traded. So he played for two teams that year. Obviously, you know, trades can affect you. He started a little slow in San Diego, and then he heated up when he came down to South Florida. But he never had a weighted runs created plus from 92 to 05. That's 13 years below 123. And the next lowest that he had was 137. So that just shows a dominance over a long, long period of time. It shows how amazing he was consistently, that he never stopped. And it was always dominant. It was always Gary Sheffield. He was always going to crush you. And he hit 509 home runs in his career. It's, you know, 500 home run club, that's pretty much it. You know, I don't know if there are any guys in the 500 home run club that aren't in the Hall of Fame. So to me, it's a no-brainer. You know, the batting stance has to stand for something, right? That was so iconic, and he was such an iconic player because of it, and because of how imposing he was at the plate, that I just can't see any way. He's one of those guys that you look at him and you say, obviously, he's a Hall of Famer, right? Because he was so good. So to me, absolutely, Gary Sheffield, 100% a Hall of Famer. I want to hear from you guys when I tweet out the pod. I'm going to put up a poll. I want to hear what you guys have to say. I know a lot of Marlins fans are going to say, yes, you want that Marlin. You hope that Gary would wear a Marlins hat in, and I think there's a good case that he would, because his best years probably were in Miami. Now we're going to do something new on the show, something I'm going to be introducing, and this will be a continuation, a thing that we're going to be running every day, or every show, I mean, until we do the Barry Bonds episode. Barry Bonds was so unbelievably good at baseball, and sometimes it's just impossible to believe. Some of the stats that he put up over his career and some of the things that kind of played out over his career are so unbelievable, and if you look up crazy Barry Bonds stats, there are really some unbelievable things out there. So I want to shout out my boy LaFontaine and IDB1127 out on Twitter. They came up with a great idea for me, and they called it, I think Christian called it, Two Bonds and a Lie. That's where he pretty much presented me with the name, but they presented me with the idea. So I want to give a big shout out to them for the idea.
I know that I'm a Hall of Fame player. I don't really need to get into that. I'll leave that to you guys to make that determination.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you three statistics. Two of them are true. One of them's a lie. So it's two truths and a lie, but it's two bonds and a lie. And I'm going to put up a poll where I'm going to ask everybody which one they think is the lie. And then next week, I'll let you know which one was the lie. So you got to listen next week. It'll be right at the beginning of the show next week. You got to listen so you can hear. And then at the end of the show next week, I'll give you guys another one. So here we go. Here are the three statistics. Two are true. One is a lie. Let's go. In 2004, Barry Bonds reached base more times than he had at bats. That's the first one. The second one. Bonds had a higher weighted runs created plus in his final season than Stan Musial and Jimmy Fox did in their entire career. So two legends, Jimmy Fox and Stan Musial. Did Bonds have a higher weighted runs created plus in his final season than they did in their entire careers? The third one, the difference between Barry Bonds and the next highest number of intentional walks in a career is higher than the amount of intentional walks the next player has. So basically, the next player's number, the difference between Bonds and the next player, the difference is higher than how many walks, intentional walks, the next guy had. I just want to make that clear. I think you guys get it, but if you don't, I can explain it another time. Anyway, let me repeat those so that everybody hears them and can sit on them and think about them. The first one, in 2004, Barry Bonds reached base more times than he had at bats. The second one, Bonds had a higher weighted runs created plus in his final season than Stan Musial and Jimmy Fox did in their entire careers. And the third one, the difference between Barry Bonds and the next highest number of intentional walks in a career is higher than the amount of intentional walks the next player has. Those are your two bonds and a lie. I want you to tell me which one you think is the lie. We're not searching for the truths. We're searching for the lie here. It'll be revealed on the next show. I'm going to put up a poll on Twitter along when I tweet out the show where you guys can vote for which one you think is the lie. And then next week, I'll tell you guys if you are right. Next week, what's going on next episode? Not next week. Right now, I'm going to be doing episodes every 2 weeks. That's kind of fitting the best schedule for me. If you want more content, I think that I might be able to do every week. Right now, I'm going to try every 2 weeks, but if it comes up that I need to do more content, maybe as we get closer, maybe stuff comes up, I'll be releasing, you know, more content if you guys want it. But for now, every 2 weeks. Next episode will be our first guest. My buddy Alex Reeveman will be joining us. He'll be filling out his own ballot. Reeveman's a good buddy of mine. Him and I, this is kind of where my love for the Hall of Fame started, with him just talking about the ballot and talking about how terrible some of the results on the ballot were, and obviously about how great Barry Bonds is. So I'll have him on to guess the two bonds and a lie next week. He'll also be revealing his ballot, and I think it should be interesting because Reeveman and I see eye to eye on a lot of things, but there are also a lot of things on this ballot that I don't really think we'll see eye to eye on. So I don't know his full ballot, actually, but I'm interested to see it when it comes out. After Reeveman, we'll be doing the Andrew Jones episode, and then we'll figure it out after that, but it'll go Reeveman, Andrew Jones. The next cases after Andrew Jones are Billy Wagner and Scott Rolen. We'll see how they play out, whether I have a guest on in between there or something. So that is what the future is looking like here on Big Hall Talk.